straight away. And Claire Bailey is going to come and read from these little booklets. But first, she's going to explain to us how she became a Christian. So, Claire, thanks for that. So, coming over to you.
Hey, everyone. I grew up thinking I knew about Christianity. I went to a Church of England school and church at Christmas and Easter, but I didn't think about any of it very much. I believed in a God, but it didn't have much of an impact in my life. After all, if there was a God, why would he care about me? I believed that Jesus probably existed and that he probably did say the things written in the Bible, but at the end of the day, how could anyone actually be the Son of God? When I came to Cambridge in 2003, I quickly threw myself into the typical student life. I went out drinking and clubbing most nights and started to smoke pot. I tried really hard to fit in and found myself going from one relationship to another. I was only focused on my life and didn't make much time for anyone else's problems. Despite this, my friends stuck by me. I'd quickly realized that a lot of my friends were strong Christians. In fact, a few of them were far too outspoken for my liking. So when they invited me to a talk like this in my first year, I promised to go to one, just to get them off my back. I was still unconvinced that God wanted a relationship with me. I didn't think Jesus was anything more than a good man. Whatever religious faith I had was very personal to me, and I couldn't stand people interfering. In the Easter term of my second year, just when I thought my friends were finally off my back, I suddenly realized that I did have questions about Christianity. I started to go to church with my friends, but the first time I went, I felt really uncomfortable. A friend encouraged me to try again, and I'm really glad I did. The Bible talks of God calling us to himself, and looking back, I realized that God was calling me. He was letting me know that he did want a relationship with me. The distant God I had believed in until then was rapidly becoming more personal to me. I even found myself praying to him and asking him questions, which is something I never thought I'd do. While at home during the summer, I started to read the Bible a bit, but it wasn't until Michaelmas term of my third year that it started to make sense to me. I was going to church most Sundays, and it was here that God started answering my questions. It suddenly occurred to me that all this time, I'd been asking God to prove himself to me. I'd find myself wandering around, willing him to do things so that I might believe in him. A sermon at church made me realize that this route wouldn't bring me answers. So, from that point on, I tried my best not to challenge God, but to listen to him and open my mind more. Over the following weeks, I began to understand more about why Jesus had come and what he had done for me on the cross. I had chosen to ignore God, but Jesus had paid the price for my rebellion against God so that I could have a relationship with him. I started reading John's Gospel and talked about questions I had with my Christian friends. I realized in late October that God did want a relationship with me and that Jesus really was the Son of God. I knew I had a choice to make: to follow Jesus, or to turn my back on the truth. It took me over a month to make the decision. I knew that if I became a Christian, I would have to make some sacrifices, and I wasn't sure I was willing to. It was at the Christian Union Carol Service on the 29th of November in 2005 that I was finally persuaded to put my trust in Jesus. As I sat in the church, it felt like the speaker was talking directly to me. He said that if you believed in Jesus, I knew that you had a decision to make. You should just do it. Join him in saying a prayer to give your life to Jesus. I was petrified. I didn't think I could do it, but when he started praying, I found myself joining in. And before I knew it, I'd become a Christian. It was an amazing feeling, and I felt so relieved afterwards. It's been 15 months now, and my life is very different. I still struggle with the idea that God really does want a relationship with me. But at the same time, I know a level of peace in my life that I've never known before. I don't rely on other people or other things to make me feel secure. And I don't worry about the future, because I know God will be there for me. All in all, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I don't regret for one minute searching for the truth about Jesus. Okay, we're going to read from the Gospel of Mark. It's chapter 14, starting at verse 32, which is at the bottom of page 45. Mark 14, verse 32. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." Going a little farther, he fell to the ground and prayed that, if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Simon," he said to Peter, "are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak." Once more he went away and prayed the same thing. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. Returning the third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough! The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer."
Thanks very much, Claire. Great stuff. Well, the question we're going to look at today particularly is that question Jesus asked, "Are you asleep?" And Philip Jensen's going to come and help us understand that passage. So over to him.
Thanks, Barnaby. Tonight I'm going to invite you to become a Christian and offer you the opportunity to do so right here and now. Just as Claire described how she became a Christian at the carol service in 2005, so I'm going to offer you the opportunity of becoming a Christian here on Friday night at the main event of this cross-examined series of talks. It's a little hard for people, I know. Some people are not ready, and that's all right. No one's going to force you. I mean, in the comment cards from the last few nights, you see some say, "I'm not ready to give up my independence." That's understood, the message. It is about that, giving up your independence, depending upon Christ. Others, I'm confused and scared. I'm sorry, I hope that we will clarify the confusion and remove the fear. I thought I was a Christian, but in fact, I'm just the rich man. But I'm praying to become a Christian. I'm not good enough to be a Christian, but I'm prepared and am trying. Now, for me to say I'm going to invite you to become Christians has certain implications, doesn't it? Firstly, it seems to imply a judgment on my part about you that you are not a Christian. Of course, I can't know everybody who's here. It's unreasonable for me to make such a judge. But clearly, some of us are Christians, some of us are not Christians, and some of us are unsure whether we're Christians or not. I want us to leave tonight at least sure whether we're Christians or not. Hopefully, sure that we are, but at least sure whether we are or not. Secondly, my invitation implies that you can become a Christian. You're not just one because you're Anglo-Saxon or because your parents are or because you were baptized or because you go to Christmas and Easter services or because you belong to a Christian nation or a Christian tribe. Christianity is not something gathered by osmosis. It's not just something that grows on you or you necessarily grow into or drift into. There are steps to be taken to become a Christian. And I'm going to lay that out for you in a little moment or two. Thirdly, my invitation also implies that you're not beyond hope because I'm inviting everybody to become a Christian. It's not too far for anybody. Nobody is beyond becoming a Christian because of what they've done or what they've thought or what they've said. That's because Christianity is not morality. Christianity is a relationship with God. Becoming a Christian is about being in a relationship with God. And therefore, it's about being forgiven, not being good. If the basis of being a Christian is being good, nobody's a Christian. And those who go to church and claim to be Christian are hypocrites. But that's not what Christianity is about. It's not about being good. It's about being forgiven. The church is not full of hypocrites. There's always room for a few more to come. You join them anytime you like. It's not full of hypocrites, though, because the church is the only organisation I know of where you have to admit that you are guilty in order to join. I mean, you join a golf club, they'll want testimonies to the fact that you're good and moral. You go to the prisons, they all tell you they didn't do it. You go to church and they say, I'm a sinner and a wretch. In fact, the church I belong to, we say, I'm a miserable sinner. Which doesn't mean that I'm not good at sinning, but it means, yes. And you have to say that to be a member. It's the only organisation where you have to confess your crime in order to get in. So when you see Christians are not good people, well, that's right, that's not what we're professing. We profess to be forgiven people. That's what we profess to be. And it's not about morality. If it's about morality, you'll never know whether you're a Christian or not. That's why I want to draw attention to this. It's an anonymous card. I'm not good enough to be a Christian, but I'm prepared and I'm trying. Yes, if it's a matter of being good enough, you'll never know whether you're good enough. But it's not about being good enough, it's about being forgiven. And the relationship with God is based on that forgiveness. And you either are in a relationship or you're not in a relationship with God. It's quite binary, it's one or the other. You either are in a relationship with Barnaby or you're not in a relationship with Barnaby. Either you know him and he knows you, or you don't know him and he doesn't know you. But we could do a show of hands here. All those who know Barnaby, put their hands up, and put their, all those who don't know him. You're not going to be in too much of a doubt, are you? And if you are in any doubt, you can fix it up over supper, can't you? So that you will know that you are in a relationship with him. It's you either know or don't know God. But the key thing about knowing God is, how can I come to know God as my God? Forgiveness is necessary. So how do we do it? Well, by prayer. In the Bible, in the little Mark's Gospel, there is this prayer that I've been praying each night and will pray again tonight for you to help you understand how to become a Christian. You'll see in the prayer that there are three paragraphs to it. The first acknowledges our present state, that is, that we live unacceptably to God because we are guilty of rebelling against him and ignoring him. Being ignorant of him is not the same as ignoring him, is it? You may be ignorant of Barnaby. Well, more's the pity for you. But that's completely different to knowing him and ignoring him. You see him walking down the street and you think, here he comes, and you nick around the corner so that you don't have to talk to him. That's ignoring him. If you don't know him, well, that's nobody's fault. But if you do know him and you ignore him, oh, that indeed is your fault, isn't it? And so our attitude to God is to rebel against God. Our attitude to God is to say, well, I don't care if there's a God or not. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. That is ignoring him. And if God is God, I need forgiveness. The second paragraph thanks God for what he has done in the person of Jesus, sending his son to die for us that we might be forgiven and raising him again to new life that we might be changed. Claire spoke of being changed over these months since she has become a Christian. Life is different. It does change you once you have Jesus as your ruler. And so the third part of the prayer is the prayer. Please forgive me. Please change me. And if that is genuinely the prayer of your heart and life, you will be forgiven. You will be changed. Because God has sent his son into the world so that you'll be forgiven and has raised him again to give you a new life. So tonight's meeting I'll finish by praying. praying to show you how easy and simple it is to pray this prayer. The words are easy, anyone can rattle out the words. The reality is what matters, but to show you how simple. I'll pray it also to demonstrate that I mean what I say. I'm inviting you to become a Christian this night, right here, right now. And thirdly, I'll pray the prayer tonight so as to give you the opportunity to become a Christian right now. But in order to see what the prayer is about, each night I've been explaining part of it by studying passages in Mark's Gospel. Tonight I hope to help your understanding and to help to motivate you to accept this invitation to pray by explaining that second paragraph, first sentence, "Thank you for sending your son into the world to die for me that I may be forgiven." And so explaining the passage that Claire read for us from Mark chapter 14 on pages 45 and 46 in our little Mark's Gospel. Beginning to run a little low on these, so if you wouldn't mind leaving them behind tonight, you can pick one up tomorrow, that would be helpful. Now everybody dies. Some die in cruel and unjust fashion, like Jesus. Most people don't. But what's so special about Jesus' death? Why is that so central to becoming a Christian, to being a Christian, to life itself? What does his death mean? A person's last words, a person's epitaph, often express what their life and their death is about. The Victorians were very big on writing up death scenes and last words for people. And of course, humorists have often picked up on the epitaphs and last words of people. H.L. Mencken is a very, very funny American humorist of the early 20th century. And his last words were recorded. He actually gave them to a taxi driver. Taxi driver dropped him off and said to him, as is the wont with American taxi drivers, "Have a good night, Mr. Mencken. And Mr. Mencken said, "I'll have whatever kind of bee night I like, thank you." Slammed the door, went upstairs, had a heart attack and died. That's a way to finish life, isn't it? "I'll have whatever kind of night I like." But I presume he didn't, really. I don't think heart attack was on the plan. Another one who didn't know really what he was saying was John Sedgwick, the general at the Battle of Spotsylvania, in one of the most quotable and famous quotes of all. For he said in 1864, and these are his last words, "They couldn't hit an elephant at this distance." You know you shouldn't laugh at that, don't you? But well, there's from the Wild West on a tombstone in Wichita, Kansas, the great saying, all it says, it's unnamed, the person's unnamed, but it says, his whole epitaph, "He called Pete Smith a liar." It's a good message, isn't it? And of course, the one I love, because it's in Australia, Spike Milligan, the goon who moved to find a paradise, a place called Woi Woi, just north of Sydney, near Wagga Wagga and Wee War and other places that, no, it's nowhere near any of those, but Woi Woi. Spike Milligan has on his tombstone, in Irish, so you've got to be able to read it the right way, but I can't, but he has written on his tombstone, "I told you I was ill." One of the famous death scenes of all times, of course, is Socrates. He was condemned to execution by drinking poison because he was seen to be corrupting the morals of youth. Socrates has a last discussion with his friends and they come to his prison to see it happen. He stays cool, calm, controlled, eminently rational and reasonable as only Socrates could be. So there is recorded for us this final dialogue with his friends and Socrates. And he persuades them that all their weeping and wailing is not for him but for them, because they actually believe he'll be better off being freed from the bodily existence of this world. And so they're not grieving for him, they're grieving for themselves. In fact, so persuasive is he that they decide they'll drink hemlock as well and suicide with him. He then sets out a long argument as to why it is it's wrong to suicide. And it's one of the very first anti-suicide discussions in Western literature. And so, being Socrates, he persuades them not to suicide, but that he will, because that's how he was to be executed, by drinking the poison. His parting words with them are, "And now we go, I to death, you to life. But which is for us the better state? God only knows." Here is his last words. How different is the other execution of an innocent teacher, Jesus? People love to compare and contrast Socrates and Jesus in their death. You'll find it in that philosophical novel, Sophie's World, that came out a few years ago. Time magazine, writing up a renewal of interest in Jesus again, compares Socrates. And there are points of similarity. They're both executed. They're both accused of corrupting the morality of the society. They both have disciples and so on. But the reality is totally different. That's why the passage that we read tonight is so important. Because there we see Jesus not like Socrates. He's not cool. He's not philosophical. But in agony. Look with me at page 45 there in verses 33-34. He took Peter. James and John, page 45, along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said. "Stay here and keep watch." Going a little further, he prayed. Here is Jesus, not in philosophical discussion, but deep in prayer. But more than deep in prayer, deeply distressed, troubled, overwhelmed with sorrow as if he's going to expire. This is not like Socrates, not like any description of Socrates, nor is it like any description of Jesus in the rest of the gospel. I mean, this is the man who walked on water. This is the man who stilled the storms with a word. This is the man who touched the leper, and instead of leprosy coming upon him, the leper was cleansed. This is the man who healed all manner of sickness. This is the man who had crowds gathered around him all the time, pressing upon him, and always stayed calm, always in control. This is the man who raised the dead, who expelled evil spirits with just a simple word to them. This is the man who fed multitudes. This is the man who always is in control of every situation he comes in. Doesn't matter how dangerous, doesn't matter how weird, doesn't matter how much pressure, the Jesus of Mark's gospel strides forth in control, completely having all things under his sovereignty. He is the master of every context. And then suddenly now, we see him deeply distressed, overwhelmed by what is happening. So the sorrow that's to the point of death, why? Why wasn't he like Socrates? Cool, calm, controlled, calming his disciples, telling them of their anxiety, need not. He's the only one anxious. His disciples don't have to be calm, they're asleep. He is the one person in the situation who is in trouble. Why was Jesus distressed? What did Jesus know about death that Socrates didn't know about death? For Socrates himself says that he doesn't know what death holds. Only God knows whether you're going to be better off alive or I'm going to be better off dead. Only God knows. I don't know. But Jesus did. Jesus and all the Bible readers No. Jesus knew that death was the penalty for rebellion against God. Jesus knew that God was angry with rebellion. Jesus knew because the Bible tells us, and Jesus was a man of the Bible. The wrath of God was to be experienced in death. The wrath of God that is not just a temperamental anger, but a just anger with rebellion against Him. For in our death, we come face to face with God. And if God is angry with us, we come face to face with the angry God. That's completely different to Socrates. For unlike Socrates, who didn't know whether to live or to die was better, Jesus knew, because God had explained death in his scriptures, and so Jesus knew what death held for him. The scriptures teach that humans have chosen life without God. We'd rather live our own way, doing our own thing, ruling the world without God. We basically say to God, butt out of my life. And the judgment that God gives us fits the crime perfectly. He butts out of our life. He gives us what we're asking for, life without Him. We're given our freedom to do what we like in our rebellion. You see the freedom in first year in the colleges, don't you? When people come and choose to live, as Claire described her life, racing from one stupidity to another, excuse me, Claire. But racing from one to another, isn't it? From drink, to pot, to sex, to fun, to party. Looking for relationship, looking for love, looking for meaning, looking for just running. Some, of course, are never found again, really. Others wise up. We chose life without God. Therefore, God gives us just what we ask for, existence without Him. For that's what death ultimately is. It's separation from God. But when you're separated from God, don't for a minute rub your hands with atheistic glee and say, at last I'm free from all those God botherers. Because God is the source of life. God is the source of all good things. God is the God of creation who gives us everything that is worth having. God is our maker, our owner and ruler. Love, joy, peace, relationships, kindness, gentleness, they all come from God. In this world, God has not given us up totally, but in death, there is no God and nothing good that comes from God. It all goes. Australians love their pubs. And the average ocker Aussie who has rejected God will speak of the afterlife with very warm, positive terms. It's going to be terrific. I'll be there with all my mates because they don't believe in God either. And we'll be just on an eternal pub crawl. Well, there will be Australian pubs in hell, I suspect. But there won't be any wine, there won't be any drink, there won't be any food, because that comes from God. And there won't be any mateship, because mateship comes from God. There will be other people, the kinds of people you can't live with. They'll be there. See, everything good comes from God. You remove yourself from God, that's the choice you make. Ultimately, you will remove yourself from everything that is good, that flows from God. Jesus knew in his death he would face the separation from his Father. He could see that within 24 hours of this prayer, he would be on the cross crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you abandoned me? Why have you deserted me? There are very few pains as painful as being deserted by somebody whom you put your trust in. Tomorrow night, don't miss when I talk to you about that verse and that experience of death that Jesus had and what it meant when he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? and why he cried it out and what the question is and why it's a question. And it's the most awesome cry of all eternity, that cry on the cross, the cry of dereliction. What it meant is the last in this series. But you see, Jesus knew the Old Testament scriptures. He knew what they prophesied about him. For example, in Isaiah 53, he knew that it said, "We all like sheep have gone astray, each has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all." He knew he was the one upon whom the Lord was laying all the iniquity of the world. That same Old Testament scriptures written hundreds of years before Jesus would be saying, yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. The Lord was to make his life a guilt offering. He knew what he was coming to do. He was coming to be crushed by God, his Lord. He knew that he was to have all the iniquity of the world laid upon him so that he could be a guilt offering. That's why he couldn't approach death with calm indifference. Because unlike Socrates, he knew what death meant and he knew what his death meant. What we see in Jesus' death is the spiritual agony. For Jesus' agony was spiritual much more than physical. Here's the basic problem with Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion. It's full of historical inaccuracies, adding into the original accounts all kinds of legendary accretions. But its basic problem is the problem of almost all visual presentations. The emphasis must fall on the physical suffering. Because that's what you can show in a painting. That's what you can show in a film. Its emphasis, therefore, on the suffering of the thorns in the crown and of the whips that took the flesh off his bones, or of the blood pouring out and of the nails. It's a gory movie of spitting upon him and of beating him and of... It's a dreadful piece of gore. Crucifixion was physically painful, it's true. But that's not what Jesus was concerned about. It was the spiritual reality of the death that you cannot photograph, that is in the prayer, that is in the cry of dereliction. The pain was the spiritual pain. As a physical experience, there was nothing particularly unusual about Jesus' death. Thousands of Israelites died by this cruel method called crucifixion. Jesus was just one of them. And apart from crucifixions and Jews, thousands and thousands, millions of martyrs have died for all kinds of causes, and all kinds of people have been killed in dreadful ways, haven't they? What's so special about this death? It wasn't that he suffered more than any other person has ever suffered. Have you checked out what English history has done to some people around here in terms of suffering? This nation has had a pretty ghoulish history of doing things unmentionable to bodies. Now, Jesus doesn't suffer physically more than anybody else that we record his death, but his real agony can be seen when he comes to the prayer on the night he was betrayed, the day before his execution, for there is the real battle that marked out his death. For while he prayed repeatedly, back and back he went, struggling for some considerable length of time, the disciples slept. Have they just had a Passover dinner? It's like our annual Christmas dinner. And they slept. Repeatedly he returned to them, "Are you asleep?" He comes back again, "Are you still sleeping?" The physical battle of the arrest and the crucifixion, they could see, they could fight, or they could flee from. But the spiritual battle that was happening, they couldn't see. They couldn't even stay awake for it. The salvation of the world is hanging in the balance and they're asleep. They don't even know what's happening. Like them, so many of us are asleep, unconscious of what the death of Jesus was about, unaware of the conflict by which he was saving the world. Oh yeah, we know Jesus died. So, Oh, yeah, he was crucified. Yeah, yeah, they put nails in, yeah. We haven't understood. But yet it's here in the Bible. So let us take the moment or two looking at it. And as we approach this prayer, we've got to be careful. Because actually we're invading privacy when you listen in on somebody else's prayer, aren't you? Especially when you're listening into somebody else's prayer when they're struggling with God and with death. This is not just kind of listening in overhearing somebody else's conversation. This is a real serious conversation of the most extreme nature. You're listening in to the man who's praying with God on the subject of his death that is coming upon him. And in fact, when we listen to this one, who is really God's son praying, we're treading on very holy ground tonight. Firstly, notice in verse 35, it's on page 46, there's a summary of the prayer, of what Jesus was praying for. He prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. The hour was his appointment with his destiny. The hour was his appointed betrayal, his trial, his execution, the thing that was about to come. You can see the hour down in verse 41, for he says, enough, the hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Look, the betrayer is here. That's the hour. And so he is praying that this appointment with death might be missed, that might pass from him. That is, he was praying not to die. He didn't want to die. Quite rightly. People who want to die are mentally unbalanced. They need help. We protect them from their self and from self-harm. It's one of the things for which we lock people up, because we know that they have a serious, unbalanced view of life, and with a little help they'll get past it. Jesus is not mad. He doesn't want to die. It's madness that wants to die. And if you know about the wrath of God, it's more than madness to want to die. Jesus does not want to die. He shrinks from the awful reality of death. Because he knows in the reality of death is not just meaninglessness, he knows in the reality of death is the wrath of God, and he pulls back from it, if at all possible. If there's some other time, more than that, may the time never come, may the hour pass from me. Maybe there's some other person, maybe there's some other way, maybe there's some other plan that you can come up with, but please, don't bring me to this dreadful appointment. Take this destiny away from me. And then in verse 36, the prayer is recounted for us. Abba, Father, he said, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. Here is the cup to die for. Here is the drink of death. Not the hemlock that kills a philosopher, but the wrath of God that kills the Prince of Life and saves humanity at the same moment. Now let's take a few moments to analyse the prayer. Start with the basis of the prayer. It has twofold basis, namely the characteristics of God. Firstly is relationship. He has a relationship with God whom he calls Abba, Father. It's a personal, intimate relationship of trust that he has with his Father. The Father-child relationship in the Bible is one of loving trust and intimacy. I know that not all of us have had good relationships with our Father. In a group this large, some of us have had dreadful relationships with our Father. And the idea of thinking of calling God Father can actually be repulsive to us, because we've been so scarred by the dreadful things that our Father has done for us. But why do you find it so dreadful, the things that your Father has done for you? Well, Philip, it's because they were dreadful. No. It's because they were dreadful and they were done to you by your Father. If the same dreadful things had been done to you by a stranger, they would be dreadful. But because they've been done to you by your Father, they are doubly dreadful. That's why they have such deep, profound psychological agony within your heart and mind and person. Because your Father is the person who should protect you. Your father is the person who should provide for you and teach you and train you and care for you. The fact that that is the person who has done those dreadful things to you is why it is so profoundly damaging. But do not turn your back on fatherhood because of that. Understand that it's another example of how important fatherhood is. For no one can hurt you quite so much as someone who should be looking after you. God is the Father who protects and provides and teaches and disciplines as fathers should. And we as his children should, as children, be able to depend upon our fathers and submit to them and learn from them how to live and how to catch fish and how to throw them back, how to play a game and how to read a book. We learn from, because we are lovingly cared for, and Jesus approaches his God as his Father. He teaches, even you who are evil, you fathers, you know how to give good gifts to your children. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Because none of us are perfect fathers. Most of you, I guess, haven't been fathers. Been one for many years now. And yeah, none of us are perfect fathers. We goof. We make mistakes. But even though we make mistakes, we know how to give good gifts to our children. In fact, nothing makes a father feel more fatherly than being asked for something good and right that he can provide for his children. Giving to your children is just one of the great joys of life. It's a wonderful feeling when they say, "Could I have?" And you can reach in your pocket and pay for it and give it to them. And watch their little face explode with excitement and pleasure and joy in trusting you. There's nothing more joyful in fathering than to be able to give generously. That leads us to the second characteristic of God, though, ability. For that also is part of the prayer. You see, he says, "Abba, Father, everything is possible for you." And Jesus had taught this. He taught this back in chapter 9 of Mark's Gospel, when a father says to him, "If you can, please help me with my sick son." And Jesus said, "If you can, all things are possible with God." We saw it last night, those of us who were here last night, with the disciple and the rich man. He said, they said, "Well, who can be saved?" And Jesus says, "With men it's impossible, but not with God. All things are possible with God." Jesus himself taught this to others, and now he is having to put it to the test. Because Jesus wasn't praying to an impotent Father and God. He was praying to the omnipotent Father. The Father who could do anything and everything and all things. Who could stop the cross right now. Who could rapture him up out of the garden and bring him back home to heaven. Who could call down the angels in all their armies and rescue him from the Roman soldiers. He was praying to the God and Father who could stop it right now. And he's praying for rescue right now. And he's pouring his heart and saying, "I don't want to do it." And as he prays to the Father who could do all things, he makes the request. But it's a twofold request. It's the kind of request which shows what the old psychologists used to call the approach avoidance conflict. I want this, but as I get closer to it, I realize I'm missing out on that. So I go over to this, and now I want that. And so I don't know which of these two I'm wanting. The more I approach one, the more I don't, and I don't know. Jesus has got two things happening. For he prays his immediate request, but he also has an ultimate request. His immediate request, "Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me." The cup is a biblical image of drinking the wrath of God. And what he's asking for doesn't seem to be unbiblical, because back in Isaiah's day, Israel was to drink the cup of the wrath of God down to the very dregs, but they turned to God in prayer, and so God takes the cup of wrath from them and gives it to their enemies. And so Jesus is saying, "Take the cup from me now. Take it from me. Why do I have to drink the cup now? Please take it from me." If it's at all possible, take it from me. To appreciate what is happening here, it's essential we grasp the horror, the fearful, appalling, awful, horrendous, unbearable horror of drinking the cup of God's wrath. It's not a popular notion. The popularity is in irrelevance to truth, isn't it? Of course it's not popular, especially to those who are not forgiven. But the scriptures say it is a dreadful thing, a thing full of dread. It is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Why? Because the same book says, our God is a consuming fire. Oh, everybody likes the phrase where it says, God is love. And it does say God is love. And God is truth, and it does say God is truth. But it also says God is a consuming fire. And it's an awful thing, a dreadful thing to fall into his hands. Judgment has been trivialized and ridiculed in our public media discussion address for far too long. Pitchforks, horns, tails, opera cloaks, black and red, giggling stupid little demons. In Australia it sells everything, that kind of stupidity, from barbecued tools to ice creams. The devil is used and hell is used as a cheap shot. But go, my friends, to Rwanda. Take your minds, my friends, back to Serbia. Back to the ethnic cleansing where little children were tortured before execution. Go to the Sudan, where for 20 years people were murdered and massacred. And even now in Darfur, millions are facing starvation because of the war that has raged without righteousness for decades. Go to the Holocaust, to never lose touch with it. Down the Imperial War Museum in London, just before I came up to Cambridge, I went around there and there was the Holocaust exhibition. Go and have a look at Auschwitz. Look at Belsen. Look what humanity has done to humanity. You want to see hell? Read what happened in Siberia. Read about the life of those who lived in the Gulag Archipelago. Read what humans have done to humans in the salt mines of Siberia. Well, go and think again of the killing fields. The 18 months of the monstrosities of Pol Pot, where one third of the population was killed in 18 months. Or come again this Easter to remember Armenia, where in just a month, one third of the population was exported, one third was brought into slavery, and one third was executed in a month. Or go to the Congo. Go and look at little children who are soldiers, 8-year-olds, murderers, trained to kill. Or look at the slaves that are being captured and taken, the children who are still there. Or go to Southeast Asia, parts of India, and find the small children, the small girls who are being sold into prostitution, the little boys being used for the pedophiles, the AIDS not considered. You want hell? When you see it, it makes you cry for justice. Social engineering is an irrelevance in the sight of the barbarity of humanity. It's punishment that is needed. It is justice that is cried for. And it's not always outside here. You see, we live in a society, I do and you do, that has been profoundly influenced by biblical and Christian understanding, which has given rise to whole systems of justice and policing and equity. And we've also had the enormous benefit of wealth and prosperity, whereby there is enough to share for everybody. But even in our societies, murder and rape and abuse and use, a crowd this big, I know, there are those of you who have been used sexually, and there are those of you who have used other people sexually. It's all part of the same, isn't it? Just before Christmas, a week or two before Christmas, one of the street people who live on the square of the cathedral in which I am the dean won some money, went and bought new clothes. That night, some of the other street people killed him to take his money. He was 23. His name was Mitchell. Justice, righteousness is what's needed. Go to the courts, listen to the parents. I saw it on television here the other night. A young woman who had been shot down in the South London shootings, wasn't it? No, it was a slightly different one. I can't remember which one now. It's the one where at the baptism where she was killed nursing a little baby. And the parents were saying, well, it's all right, he's got 20, 30 years, but where is our daughter? She's got no life. It's not enough. It's not enough. It's been very interesting to hear how muted the nations have been who do not have capital punishment when other nations execute terrorists like Saddam Hussein. My nation doesn't believe in capital punishment, but it didn't fight to protect him from being executed. Our nation suffered a bombing in Bali. The men who have perpetrated that are now due for execution. Our nation's not going to complain about it. The popular opinion, which our politicians always follow, the popular opinion is overwhelming. They want him executed. The only people that are saying they don't want him executed are the people who think that he will be tortured more by not being executed. All very well to be calm and gentle when you're not facing hell. Jesus knew God's plan for the salvation of mankind. He knew God's plan, and he begged for any possible alternative than facing the judgment of God. The judgment of God on Belsen and Auschwitz, the judgment of God on the Babylonian captivity, the judgment of God on all the wars, all the inhumanity, all the sin of the world was going to be laid upon him, and he was going to be punished for the lot of it. Do you see why he was crying? Do you see why he was in distress? Do you see why he was in horror? He was about to face hell. All the hells of humanity were going to be lifted onto this man's shoulders. And you want him to sit around like Socrates and have a chat with his mates? He knew what was coming. It's so sad that you and I have to go to such awful subjects before we start to realize the importance of justice and righteousness. But while his immediate plan was to have the cup of God removed from him, his ultimate request was that he wants God's will to be done. That little word, yes, is the word by which the whole world is saved. Abba, Father, take this cup from me, yet not my will but your will be done. Here is the righteous Son submitting to the Father's will. Even at this point, he didn't rebel like the rest of us would. He was never self-serving. He was always God-serving and other person-serving. And therefore, he was other person-saving. It's the terrible irony when he's on the cross and they call out to him, he saved others, let him save himself. Come down from the cross and then we'll believe you. Why, if he saved others, can't he save himself? Because he cannot save himself if he is to save others. And so, while the righteous desire not to die could be said, while it was right for him not to want to be cut off from his father in death, he also affirms the ultimate desire to serve his father's will, thus making his sacrifice a voluntary sacrifice, and his obedience and submission perfect, and so making his sacrifice the one true sacrifice that can pay for the sins of the whole world. And so he prayed, and he prayed, and he prayed that he would not enter into temptation, for this was the time. And then he says, enough, the hour has come to drink the cup of God's wrath, to be severed from his father as the innocent sacrifice for the sins of the world. There are many implications in this prayer. Implications about the nature of the Trinity, implications about the nature of prayer. I won't go into those now because they're off the subject of why I was using this passage, but there are huge implications. Let me go to the central implication. To draw your attention as I come to invite you to become a Christian, the implication of his prayer for death itself and for Jesus' death in particular. For here in this prayer, we see the perfect Son of God asking his perfect Father, for whom all things are possible, that if it is all possible, he doesn't have to go through this death, though wanting his Father's will above that request. And so here in this prayer, we see what death involves. For when the Son of Man came into the world, he came into the world not to be served but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. What did it mean for him to ransom many by giving his life? It meant the awesome pain he was enduring, not physical but spiritual, by becoming the sin offering and experiencing God's wrath, though he didn't deserve it, because he was always willing to submit to his Father, even to this. He was willing to submit to his Father. For there on the cross, the unity of God, the Father and the Son, would take the rebellion of humanity upon itself, and into the very relationship of God the Father and God the Son, sin entered and death followed. Tomorrow I'll talk of it. And in this prayer we see that Jesus' death has to be a unique salvation. For there was no other way to save you and to save me. If there had been any other way, God, who can do all things, would have done it. Do you see how stupid it would be for God not to spare his Son if there was another way? Do you not see how stupid to send his Son to the cross if sin didn't matter? How stupid of God to send his Son to the cross if you didn't matter, if you were really someone who wasn't concerned. Claire spoke earlier on about not being sure that God would want a relationship. He so wants a relationship as to send his Son to die for you. You see how stupid it would be, God, if you could, of God, to see his Son die like this, if you could be good enough without a sacrifice for sin. How stupid of God if there was somebody else could save you other than his only Son. How stupid of God to see his Son sacrifice like this if all roads lead to God anyway. It doesn't matter what you believe, doesn't matter how you live, somehow you'll find whatever God you want to find. If that was vaguely true, the death of Jesus is an absolute stupidity. Why, oh why? Why did God's Son have to drink the cup of God's wrath? Why? Because of love. That's why. Jesus' death teaches us how greatly God and Jesus love us. This love of God is so easily trivialized by verbal mannerisms. Oh, God loves you. It kind of fits in with the same category as if enjoy your meal, have a nice day, honk if you love Jesus. It's obscene to use God loves you like that once you have actually spent time in the Garden of Gethsemane praying and thinking about it. See, when you're a father and you hear your child beg for something, ask for something, something good, something deserving, something right, to give it to them will make you feel like a millionaire, but to say, no, I can't afford that, is one of the hardest things you ever have to say. Especially if you could afford it, but it would mean doing something different with a family. It's very hard to say no. The advertisers have worked this out, and so they're teaching children to nag their parents. It's very hard to say no to your children. And why would you? Why would you want to deny them something that was good and right? Everything's possible to you, Father. So why would the Father deny the Son? Except that it was the only way to save the world. A world that he loved so much that he wanted to save. Here then is the love of God. God demonstrates his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Don't wait till you're good enough to become a Christian, because you'll wait till too late. You'll never be good enough. God doesn't love you when you're good. While we were still sinners, says the verse, God died for us in the person of Christ Jesus. Or that most famous of all verses of the Bible, John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have eternal life. What is the most important word in that verse? God? Loved? Gave? Only? Son? Believes? Eternal life. What's the most important word? It's the one I've left out. So, this verse is telling us how much God loves us and in what way God loves us. God so loves us that he gave his only Son. I had the privilege of a Sunday school education. Contrary to Mr. Dawkins, I believe in teaching children things. They taught me all kinds of things. They taught me songs to sing, verses to learn, verses like that verse. It wasn't until I became a Christian that I had the foggiest clue what it meant, as with most of the songs. But when I did become a Christian in my mid-teens, suddenly words that I had been taught burst forth in meaning. And I understood the extraordinary love of God for me. Unworthy, little, unimportant me. You see, I was taught to sing about the greatness of the love of God. Here was a song, I had no idea what it meant. You'll find, how could you not know what it meant? You see, I didn't know about the Garden of Gethsemane. I didn't really know about the cross. I had never thought about the things that we've been talking tonight. So after I became a Christian, I just knew the song. How greatly Jesus must have loved me. How greatly Jesus must have loved me. To bear my sin, to bear my sin in his body on the tree. God God so loved the world that he gave his only son, who cried, Abba, Father, take this cup from me, but not my will, your will be done. So come back to our little prayer on the slip.